A little bit chilly in here. Why don't you go ahead and turn in your fact sheets and teaching charts on Micah. And then we'll get it back into Nahum. Surrealistic. Okay. Nahum 1:4. So here he begins to express the attributes of God that are relevant to the cause of Nineveh's soon to be described doom. Remember, chapter 1 it's declared, chapter 2 it's described, and chapter 3 it's seen as being deserved. Verse 4, he rebuketh the sea. This may be a reference back to the Red Sea, which of course was involved a judgment. They were being brought out of Egypt, and Egypt was judged for their sin. And the sea itself can rebuke, can refer to that nation itself being rebuked of God. You don't usually say you rebuke a sea. You know, usually there's a splitting of a sea or something like that, but it's showing again the antitype. We saw in Micah 4:3, rebuking strong nations afar off. Same point. Rebukes the sea and makes it dry, and dries up all the rivers. Bashan languishes, and Carmel, and the flower of Lebanon languishes. So here, these are all, as we've seen, symbols of fertility, but now they are going to be made barren. Lebanon, fed by perennial snows, same thing. The mountains quake at him, and the hills melt, and the earth is burned at his presence, yea, the world, and all that dwell therein. So this is a multiple prophecy. It's looking beyond what happened at Nineveh to the end of time as well, with entire nations represented by these mountains. Revelation 17:9 is our identity key there. Trembling at the coming of him, at the second coming, for example. And then after the short season of Satan, there is that the entire world passing away. So I believe that's even telescoped at the rear of this prophecy. Who can stand before his indignation? And who can abide in the fierceness of his anger? His fury is poured out like fire, and the rocks are thrown down by him. His indignation, you can tie in Isaiah 26:20, where he tells his people to hide themselves until that indignation be passed. Also Isaiah 34:2, the indignation of the Lord upon all the nations. Verse 7, the Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knows them that trust in him. So here we have an antithesis. God's people can trust, literally, can take refuge in Him in that day. Of course, Revelation 3:10 fits in here, doesn't it? I will keep you out of that hour because you've kept the word of my endurance. Verse 8, but with an overrunning flood will He make an utter end of the place thereof, and darkness shall pursue His enemies. So the floods of armies, as it were, of the Medes, Babylonians, and Scythians, who, as we read earlier, in 612 BC toppled the ancient city of Nineveh. Second of all, at the Battle of Armageddon, there is that flood and darkness of the enemy coming in. But third of all, hell itself is referred to as outer place of outer darkness in Matthew 22:13 and 2 Peter 2:17. Verse 9, what do you imagine against the Lord? He will make an utter end. Affliction shall not rise up the second time. And he asks here, whatever you devise against the Lord, He will make a complete end of it. Distress will not rise up twice. So regardless of their plans, this is a good antidote, faith-building scripture in the face of the old Bilderberger Trilateral Commission, CFR, Illuminati, One World conspiracy fears, that regardless of what they devise against the Lord, He will make a complete end of it. Affliction, which is the same word that was rendered trouble back in verse 7, He's a stronghold in the day of trouble. Trouble will not rise up the second time. And indeed, Nineveh fell, never to rise again. In fact, they didn't even know where the city was for a long time. It had so thoroughly passed from the world scene until somebody stumbled on it in the sands of Assyria many, many years later, and then archaeological excavations were undertaken. End time Babylon, which is represented by Nineveh here, will also fall. And they will fall, never to rise again. Revelation 18:2, Daniel 2:34 and 35. 10, for while they be folded together as thorns, and while they are drunken as drunkards, they shall be devoured as stubble, fully dry. Now thorns, dried thorns, were commonly used as fuel and kindling for fuel for their fires in ancient times. Also, the thorn hedges can refer to their fortifications. And so Nineveh, all folded together and fortified and feeling very secure in their defenses. And yet, God says they're just going to be like stubble, fully dry. It's the type of highly combustible material, you know, like burning straw or something. You just put a match to it and poof, it almost explodes and burned so very quickly. And that's all it took to judge them. Drunken as drunkards, in the final siege against Nineveh, it is, according to Diodorus Siculus, an ancient historian, the Assyrian king Shin-Sharishkun and his captains were caught by surprise attack while in drunken revelry. And if that be the case, then we would have a reference to that here. Not unlike what happened in the fall of Babylon, when Belshazzar and his men were in high revelry when the handwriting was seen on the wall and the kingdom fell that night. Verse 11, there is one come out of thee that imagines evil against the Lord, a wicked counselor. So there was someone coming out of Nineveh who, as we're going to see here, typifies the Antichrist. Out of the world system. We see in Revelation 13:1 that beast rising up out of the sea, out of the nations. And he's called here, and he's one who imagines evil against the Lord, and he has one who plotted evil against the Lord, a wicked counselor. The Hebrew is a counselor of Belial. B-E-L-I-A-L. And that's the word which means worthlessness, And it even came to have a moral connotation as to, you know, a wickedness. Rotherham renders a counselor of the abandoned one. And he capitalizes abandoned one, showing that he feels it is a reference to Satan. Now, as far as Nineveh or Assyria is concerned, there were certain ones in their government system who were very signal types of the Antichrist, and the most outstanding one that comes to mind is Rabshakeh, who was Sennacherib's envoy, who was casting those vile, unrepeatable threats against the Israelites on Sennacherib's behalf when they had laid the city of Jerusalem under siege. This is found in 2 Kings chapters 18 and 19. Isaiah chapter 36 is parallel. But it's obviously a double prophecy. We're looking at the Antichrist here. He is that of that wicked one, as we read in 2 Thessalonians 2:8. The whole world lies in the lap of the wicked one, 1 John 5:19. So he's a wicked counselor. Counselor probably showing the idea of the great satanic wisdom that this man will have. According to Daniel 8:23, he will be understanding dark sentences, or as NAS translates, skilled in intrigue, or marginally skilled in ambiguous speech. Rotherham, he will be skillful in dissimulation. Now, dissimulation is just a softened word for lying. You know, very skillful lies. Rotherham puts in there margin enigmas. So it's going to be tremendously persuasive, satanic wisdom that will be manifested in this wicked counselor. In verse 12, thus saith the Lord, though they be quiet, and likewise many, yet thus shall they be shut down when he shall pass through. Though I have afflicted thee, I will afflict thee no more. Quiet would be better rendered, though they be at full strength. So Nineveh was at the height of their power. They were at full strength, complete, full force. Yet they were cut down when he shall pass through. Now this is ambiguous, this phrase here. Some render it, when he shall pass away. Others render it, they will be cut off and pass away. So it's either saying, when he, i.e. Nineveh's enemy, you know, Babylon's, Medes, Scythians, pass through their land, then they'll be cut down. Or it's saying they, Nineveh, will pass away. They'll be cut off and they'll pass away from the scene. Either way, it's the same point, and it's something that would be offering comfort to Judah, and it would be would strike terror to Assyria. And so he turns to Judah here then, and he says, though I have afflicted thee, Judah, I will afflict thee no more. Notice he says, I. And yet the context seems to be saying, it's been Assyria I've been using, but now I'm going to cut them down, and therefore I will not be through them afflicting you anymore. 13, for now will I break his yoke from off thee, and will burst thy bonds in sunder. And the Lord has given a commandment concerning thee, that no more of thy name be sown. Out of the house of thy gods will I cut off the graven image and the molten image. I will make thy grave, for thou art vile. So the Lord commanded concerning the king of Assyria, his name will no more be sown. See, no more descendants to sit upon the throne of Assyria. We don't know exactly how this was fulfilled, because it's not clear-cut enough in the historical annals. Some feel that it was fulfilled when Sarakus, great-grandson of Sennacherib, committed suicide, but we don't know for sure. In any case, we can be assured that it was fulfilled. I will make your grave. We see in Revelation 19:20, that the beast, or the Antichrist, and the false prophet are cast alive into the lake of fire. God, as it were, makes their grave. Lucifer is said to be brought down to the grave in Isaiah 14, verses 11 and 19. 15. Behold, upon the mountains the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publishes peace. O Judah, keep thy solemn feasts, perform thy vows, for the wicked shall no more pass through thee. He is utterly cut off. Verse 15 here is actually chapter 2, verse 1 in the Hebrew text. So here we see more Nahum, or comfort, for Zion, for Judah. And this is parallel to Isaiah 51, verse 3, by the way. So what he's saying is this. After the downfall of Nineveh, and therefore Assyria, messengers would be running through the land and letting the various nations that had been subjugated to Assyria know of the good news that their ancient foe, their subjugator, was now defeated. And so they would be coming on the mountains, the hills of Judah, and coming up to Jerusalem and bringing that good news that their enemy is defeated. And so behold, upon the mountains, the feet of him. You know, like Isaiah says, how beautiful are the feet of him. It would be a beautiful ministry, a beautiful message to deliver to Judah. It's good news when their enemy is overthrown. Now, the spiritual application, that messenger is Jesus Christ and the ministers of the gospel. And the good news is that the Son of God has been manifested to destroy the works of the devil, represented by Nineveh. Nineveh has been overthrown. And that's good news, to know that he has crushed the head of the serpent, because that results in peace. He's publishing peace. No more war. Now there is peace with God through the blood of his Son. We see that God preached peace through Jesus Christ, according to Acts 10:36. I don't think we realize the importance of our actions and words when we publish peace, when we are sent out by the Lord, when we share the gospel with people. It's an important ministry. Behold the feet, the walk of those that are on the mountains, the kingdoms, that are proclaiming peace, the gospel of Jesus Christ, that the devil has been defeated. And God sends angels to help those to publish that message, because it's so important. All the angels of God rejoice when there's one sinner that has repented. Now at the second coming, Jesus' feet will stand upon the mountains. He'll stand upon the Mount of Olives, and he'll come and publish peace by overthrowing those that have come to shed Israel's blood. And he will put a hook in their jaw and turn them back and leave but a sixth of them on the mountains. And he will proclaim peace. It'll be a millennial kingdom of peace. Here's Zechariah 14:4 and many other scriptures. Then the wicked would no more pass through Judah. No more Assyrian army. No more devil and demons and wickedness passing through the church of Jesus Christ. The wicked here again is Belial, which Rotherham again renders the abandoned one, will no more pass through you. NAS, the wicked one, will no more pass through you. Utterly cut off. So based upon that, he says, Judah, keep your feast, perform your vows. In other words, be faithful unto God in the covenant that he's given you, and he will be faithful unto you. And Judah will indeed keep their part of the covenant in the millennium. Keeping feasts, keeping their part of the Abrahamic covenant, as we see, for example, in Ezekiel 43, verses 10 and 11. All right, so there's chapter 1, Nineveh's doom declared. Chapter 2, the doom described. And in verses 1 through 5, we see a very terse and yet graphic depiction of the panic and the terror and the haste with which Nineveh tries to prepare a defense against these oncoming armies. He that dashes in pieces has come up before your face. Keep the munition, watch the way, make thy loins strong, and fortify thy power mightily. So the Medo-Babylonian Scythian army is the he that was coming up before them, encamping against the city. And so in irony, God says, keep diminution, watch the way. In other words, do everything you need to do. But of course, God knows by foreknowledge, it's all in vain to man the fortress and watch the road and to strengthen their back and to summon all their strength, as NAS renders, because it'll all be in vain. Verse 2, for the Lord has turned away better. The Lord restores the excellency of Jacob. There's your better rendering. The Lord will restore the excellency or splendor of Jacob as the excellency of Israel. For the emptiers have emptied them out and marred their vine branches. Now notice that one thing God has to do to restore Jacob's excellency is to first defeat Jacob's enemies. So one of the first things that has to be done for man to be brought into a restored place in God's image and likeness is to defeat what the devil and sin have done in him, to defeat demons, to get rid of demons. Then God can work on healing what's already the damage that's already been done and giving his knowledge and wisdom and glory. But as long as the demons are allowed to continue to decimate the harvest field of men's hearts, then it doesn't do any good to have all the other, because it'll negate all of the positive that is done. I think there's going to be a difference in the years ahead. I think that there's going to be a deliverance, a permanent deliverance coming for the Church of Jesus Christ. I don't know exactly how it's going to happen or even when, but I don't feel like things are always going to be this way, the way they are right now, in terms of the deep entrenchment of the enemy in our lives and the work that they're able to do on an ongoing basis. I just don't see that as being, I don't see us as being capable of doing what God has called us to do as long as we're always fighting these demons, you know, like we are, and never being able to get beyond certain positions. All right. Verse 3. The shield of his mighty men is made red. The valiant men are in scarlet. The chariot shall be with flaming torches in the day of his preparation. In the air, the fir trees shall be terribly shaken. So here we see a picture of the strong armies besieging Nineveh. And it's ironic that, you know, it was the ungodly destroying the ungodly. God knows how to turn the enemy against himself. We see this at the Battle of Armageddon. Every man's sword is against the sword of his brother. We read in Ezekiel 38:21. So they're dressed in red and scarlet. Some feel that they dyed their military tunics in red to strike terror into the enemy's heart as they would see that on the horizon. Others feel that was to conceal any wounds of blood. Others feel that it was actually the sun glistening off the burnished copper coverings on their shields that it made to appear red. And scarlet was a common color for military tunics. And then he describes the chariots and the glitter of the iron blades. They had sharpened iron blades on the axles of some of their chariots, which they would run through the ranks and it would slice people to ribbons, just mow them right down. And the fir trees would be better rendered, the cypress lances are being brandished. So they had these lances made out of cypress trees. And here the enemy is brandishing these lances. Lances or spears. For the chariots shall rage in the streets. Now we see back the picture back inside of Nineveh as they're trying to defend themselves hurriedly. They shall jostle one another in the broad ways. They shall seem like torches, and they shall run like lightnings. So here is described the confused preparation of the Assyrians is the attempt to muster a defense, but it's too little, too late. And so the chariots raging back and forth in the streets, you know, trying to send messages and get to the gates and the walls and so forth, do certain things. Now, a few commentators of a certain prophetic school say that these are prophecies of automobiles. Chariots raging in the streets and seeming like torches. There's the headlights and the taillights running like lightnings. You know, chariots don't go that fast, but for that matter, cars don't either. So again, I just offer that as an exegetical eccentricity worthy of a grin, if nothing else. Verse 5, "He shall recount his worthies, they shall stumble in their walk. They shall make haste to the wall thereof, and the defense shall be prepared. He, the Assyrian king, shall recount his worthies." He reviews mentally his best generals and bravest nobles. And then he shouts out the orders, and they stumble in their walk to go and to complete his orders. They're hurrying to the wall, but it's too late. The defense shall be prepared. And that refers not to Assyria's defense, but it refers to the enemy already having the covering in place. The word defense here refers to a covering that was used by the attackers to protect them and their battering rams while they besieged the walls of the city. And so the Ninevites rush to the walls only to find that this covering has already been set up by their foes. Verse 6, "The gates of the rivers shall be opened, and the palace shall be dissolved." Now these gates refer to the certain dams which controlled the Tigris and Khoser rivers, which were forced open by swelling torrents. That may be what happened anyway, because according to Diodorus Siculus, the continual storms had swollen the Tigris River and it overflowed over these gates. In any case, this is a rather interesting description of how Nineveh fell. I want to read a little bit from Meyer's commentary, M-A-I-E-R, on the book of Nahum, in which he comments on this verse. He renders it, "The gates of the rivers are opened and the palace sways." Now he gives about seven alternate interpretations for what this means, and I'm only going to read the number seven, which is his opinion, the one that he holds. Bottom of page 252, number 7, "We hold that the phrase, 'the gates of the rivers,' must be taken literally as the arrangement which, either open or closed, would help control the flow of the rivers toward the city. Fortunately, archaeological investigations have helped to clarify the situation. The Tebiltu, for example, which originally flowed through the city, could become a devastating torrent. It had repeatedly undermined palace foundations and weakened other structures. Sennacherib changed its course and perhaps expedited its flow by straightening its course and removing dangerous bends. In his comprehensive flood control program, this king also dammed the larger river, the Khoser, outside the city, and thus made a reservoir. Thompson and Hutchinson," these are archaeologists, "report that the water was restrained by a magnificent double dam with two massive river walls at some distance from Nineveh itself. In the ruins, they found traces of the original dam gates," see the gates, "or sluices, by which the water flow to the city could be increased or reduced. Nahum envisions that at the beginning of the siege, these dam gates would be closed by the enemy and the river impounded to cut off the city's supply, the waters of the Tigris being undrinkable. Later, the reservoirs completely full, these sluice gates, the gates of the rivers, would be literally opened and great masses of devastating waters swept down upon the doomed city. In consequence of this flood, the gate at which the Khoser entered the city, the Ninlil gate, and the adjacent wall would be destroyed. The Quay gate at which the Khoser left the city might also be devastated, and in the intervening city, much serious damage done. After the flow subsided, the entrance to Nineveh would have been made much easier for the besiegers." And then he he gathers further support for his position by quoting from Diodorus and other ancient historians. I don't think I'll read the rest of that there. So I think that that's probably as good an interpretation as any. I wouldn't be real dogmatic on it, only because this verse is so brief and we don't have full archaeological information. But I think that that's probably the best of a number of interpretations that have been offered. But the basic point, either way, seems to be these river gates opening somehow made an opening into the city for the enemy to come in an unexpected way. Instead of having to just batter against the walls for weeks or months trying to find a weak point and get through, or scaling the walls and coming up and over into the city, they came through a totally unexpected way. And so the palace being undermined as a result of this. Because their buildings, you know, they didn't have hardly any rocks in Mesopotamia, and they didn't have anything in the way of forests to build buildings from wood. So you didn't have buildings of stone or buildings of wood. You had buildings of mud brick, clay, earthen brick structures, which could be literally dissolved, undermining and dissolved by, you know, hydrological power, by the rushing torrents of the waters here. Verse 7. And Huzzab shall be led away captive. She shall be brought up, and her maid shall lead her as with the voice of doves, tabering upon their breasts. Huzzab may refer to the queen of Nineveh, and now she's coming out and defeated. Or some take it not as a name, but they translate it instead of transliterating it, and the translation becomes, it is determined. It is determined that they should be led away captive. So it's just talking about the certainty here of Nineveh's defeat. Others, number three, take it as Huzzab as being a symbol for Nineveh. Kind of like Shishak is a symbol for Babylon in Jeremiah 25:26. Huzzab may mean established or set firm, and therefore it could be saying Nineveh, though they are confident in their being established, in their strength, yet God will tear them apart and destroy them. Just like end time Babylon, where God says, Babylon the Great has fallen. Revelation 18:2. Whereas she had said, I sit a queen and shall see no sorrow. Revelation 18:7. Okay. Tabering means beating. So her maids come out beating upon their breasts, which of course is a sign of mourning, lamentation. Verse 8, but Nineveh is of old like a pool of water. Yet they shall flee away. Stand, stand, shall they cry, but none shall look back. So here they're calling for the people to stay and to defend the city, but they realize that it's all over, and so they flee in stark terror. But Nineveh would be better rendered, although Nineveh is of old like a pool of water, yet they shall flee away. So it's showing a contrast here. He's saying even though Nineveh is an ancient city and it's a populous city, yet her inhabitants will still flee in fear. Just like the harlot that is seen sitting on many waters in Revelation 17, 1 and 15, you know, the many nations. And then the merchants, they watch her after she's been stripped and burned with fire, and it says they're standing afar off. Revelation 18:10. Isn't that saying the same thing? They don't stand and defend the harlot church system once it's destroyed. They separate themselves from it afar off. Verse 9. Here's the enemy coming in. Take ye the spoil of silver. Take the spoil of gold. For there is none end of the store and glory out of all the pleasant furniture. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown observe that archaeological excavations have recovered gems, vases, bronze artifacts, and so forth, but no gold or no silver, which is a confirmation of the statement that the enemy had already looted the city of all of the more precious gold and silver artifacts. Verse 10, she is empty and void and waste, and the heart melteth, and the knees smite together, and much pain is in all loins, and the faces of them all gather blackness. The Hebrew seems to be saying the faces withdraw color. Or another way of saying that is they're gathering paleness. We would say it, you know, they're blanching in fear. The same Hebrew was found in Joel 2:6. And actually, we found that it could be taken either as losing color or being flushed with more color, depending on, I suppose, the degree of terror to which we're looking at here. Verse 11, where is the dwelling of the lions and the feeding place of the young lions, where the lion, even the old lion, walked, and the lion's whelp, and none made them afraid? And of course, the implication is they're gone now. Interesting to note the frequency with which the lion appears on ancient Assyrian monuments. It may have even been their national symbol. We know one thing, it's a biblical symbol of the devil. And we see then that this typifies the devil in his end time kingdom being defeated. He can be the old lion, and the young lions can refer to what? Princely demons, you know, other spirits, principalities that are under him. Goes about as a roaring lion, 1 Peter 5:8. God says, where have you been, Satan? And he says, I've been walking to and fro, up and down in the earth. Job 2:2. Verse 12, the lion did tear in pieces enough for his whelps, and strangled for his lionesses, and filled his holes with prey, and his dens with raven. The point here is the total subjugation of the surrounding nations by Assyria and how they were ripping one nation after another apart, and they were made fabulously wealthy as a result. The Assyrian god of war, Nergal, N-E-R-G-A-L, was worshipped in the form of a man-lion. He was part man and part lion, which again is significant with these statements. Raven refers to spoil or different kinds of prey. So it would just refer to all the nations that they've taken. 13, behold, I am against thee, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will burn her chariots in the smoke, and the sword shall devour thy young lions, and I will cut off thy prey from the earth, and the voice of thy messengers shall no more be heard. Notice the contrast between this verse and the last verse of chapter 1. 1:15, behold, upon the mountains the feet of him that brings good tidings, that publishes peace. So there's God's messengers. Now, in 2:13, he says, the devil's messengers that publish what? War instead of peace, shall no more be heard. So here's a contrast. The Assyrian royal heralds, which were used to convey the commands and directives of the overlord king in Assyria to the vassal kings under him, and to collect tribute, all of the gold and the silver and so forth from the various nations, are no more going to be heard because Assyria has fallen. There is coming a day when no longer will we hear the voice of Satan's messengers collecting tribute from us, giving us his doctrine and his directives, because that whole kingdom of darkness will be overthrown. J. Sidlow Baxter says here in Explore the Book, pages 201, 202, the decisive test of prediction is fulfillment. One of the unanswerable arguments for the superhuman origin of the Bible is its amplitude of fulfilled prediction. Nahum's oracle on Nineveh is an impressive instance. His reference to the gates of the rivers being opened and the palace dissolved in chapter 2:6 is striking in view of what actually happened. Read the following abbreviated extract from an article on Nahum in the Pulpit Commentary. Quote, this prophecy so precise and assured was the result of no human prevision. When Nahum prophesied, Assyria was at the height of its prosperity. No enemy in its neighborhood was left unsubdued. The distant Egypt had submitted to its arms. Phoenicia and Cyprus owned its sway. Judah paid annual tribute. Commercial enterprise had drawn unto it the riches of all nations. No one at this epoch could have foreseen the speedy end of this prosperity. In 50 years, the end came. On the death of Ashurbanipal, matters began to assume a dangerous attitude. Egypt rose against its former conqueror. Babylon revolted. The Medes, now a powerful monarchy, prepared to attack Nineveh. The successor of Ashurbanipal himself marched against the latter, sending Nabopolassar to recover Babylon. The Medes were defeated and for a time driven back. Nabopolassar also was successful and received as a reward for his service the title King of Babylon. Here he managed affairs so skillfully and strengthened himself so effectually that after 15 years he found himself able to throw off the Assyrian yoke. Nabopolassar made alliance with all the enemies of Assyria and became the ruling spirit of a strong confederacy which comprised Medes and Persians, Egyptians, Armenians, and that's probably what is usually called Scythians, and other nations, all animated with a fierce desire of revenging themselves on Assyria. About 612 BC, the allied forces attacked Nineveh but were repulsed with loss. Victory for some time hovered over the Assyrians, but the enemy, reinforced from Bactria, proved irresistible. The Ninevites, fearing for their final safety, attempted to escape from the city. They were overtaken and again shut up within their city. Now, I would say I'd put that back to about an earlier date because it fell in 612. And this is an older work here. And I think that I'd say that's about 616 for that first figure. The Ninevites, fearing for their final safety, attempted to escape from the city. They were overtaken and again shut up within their walls. Here they defended themselves for more than 2 years, when a circumstance against which no remedy availed laid them at the mercy of the besiegers. Now here's one version of the story. An unusually heavy flood of the Tigris carried away a large section of the huge rampart that surrounded the city. Through the gap thus formed, the enemy forced their way within the walls and captured the place. The town was sacked and a great number of the inhabitants were massacred. Thus fell Nineveh, and he gives 608, which I say is 612, and that's why I moved his 612 up to 616, according to the prophecy of Nahum. So completely was Nineveh destroyed, we may add, that in the 2nd century AD, even the site of it had become uncertain. All right, chapter 3, Nineveh's doom deserved. Woe to the bloody city! It is all full of lies and robbery. The prey departeth not. Literally, the city of bloods. It's in the plural, and it's talking about the bloodshed, the many lives that have been lost. Even as we see the woman that represents the harlot church drunk with the blood of saints and martyrs. Revelation 17:6. The prey departeth not. That is, her prey never fails. It never runs out. There's always plenty there for them to devour. Nineveh never ceases to live by violence. Verse 2, the noise of a whip and the noise of the rattling of the wheels and of the prancing horses and of the jumping chariots. Here again, he's describing the armies that are invading Nineveh. Rotherham has a real graphic description in verses 2 and 3. After I read verse 3 in the King James, I may go back and read that. The horseman lifteth up both the bright sword and the glittering spear, and there is a multitude of slain, and a great number of carcasses, and there is none end of their corpses. They stumble upon their corpses. So a tremendous overthrow. Rotherham, alas for the city of bloodshed, all of it deceit, of violence full, none releaseth prey. The sound of the whip and the sound of the rushing wheel and horse galloping and dancing chariot rattling along. Horsemen uplifting both the flashing sword and the lightning spear. Aye, a mass of slain and a weight of dead bodies and no end of corpses so that they stumble upon their corpses. So it's a terse but very graphic, powerful description of this overthrow. Multitude of slain, this is a double prophecy. We see also at the Battle of Armageddon, that is the case. There are 7 months burying the dead after that conflict. Ezekiel 39, verses 11 to 14. We saw the stench coming up from the northern army in Joel 2:20. Verse 4, because of the multitude of the whoredoms of the well-favored harlot, the mistress of witchcrafts, that selleth nations through her whoredoms and families through her witchcrafts. Remember, this is Nineveh's doom deserved. Now we have a reason offered. She was like a whore who allured other nations to their doom and destruction. See, Nineveh didn't always just come on militarily first. Sometimes they approached nations on a diplomatic level first and let them know that it was in their best interest to make a military alliance with Nineveh. And so once they were able to pull them within their gravitational field, as it were, they were able to influence them with their culture and their religion, their demons, and so forth. And if the nation resisted, then of course in came the hobnail boots, and they were going to be subjugated anyway. That's the way the devil often does things. First, he will try to allure and seduce, and if he can't get a person that way, then it's out and out warfare. You know, no holds barred, no pretending at all. We see an example of this with King Ahaz of Judah. Having lost confidence in the Lord, King Ahaz wooed this well-favored harlot and gladly paid her her harlot's fee. And while it did indeed free him from one enemy, he had fallen victim to a pitiless tyrant. Nineveh had come not to strengthen or to help Ahaz, but politically to deprive them of their independence, financially by exacting heavy tributes, socially by their aping Assyrian customs, and spiritually by Ahaz introducing Assyrian idolatry into the very temple of the Lord. So they paid a dear price. Our scriptures here are Isaiah 7, 1-13, 2 Kings 16, verses 7 through 9, Zephaniah 1, 8b, 2 Kings 16, 10 to 18, 2 Chronicles 28, 24, and 29, 3 through 7. If you put all those together and read them in that order, you'll see this story that I just gave you in nutshell form portrayed. All right? We see again the antitype here on the harlot church, with whom nations and kings were said to have committed fornication in Revelation 18, verses 2 and 3. And there's even literal application here to the licentious religious rites that were practiced by the Assyrians and many of these heathens. So because of the multitude of the whoredoms, notice, not just because of one or two, but there's a multitude. It came to a certain point where judgment had to come. Of the well-favored, in other words, beautiful, harlot, this comes. And it is all because of the many harlotries of the harlot, the charming one. And King James, the mistress of witchcrafts. N.A.S., the mistress of sorceries. This Hebrew word here may refer to love potions that were used by harlots to ensnare youths. And so it may involve the use of drugs and religion with sex. Shafim in the Hebrew, same word that's found in Micah 5:12, where God says of Israel, I will cut off her witchcrafts. Same one that's used of Jezebel, in 2 Kings 9:22, where God says Jezebel and her witchcrafts are many. Same scripture found word in Isaiah 47:9 and 12, referring to Babylon, where it says the multitude of thy sorceries. And there is that depiction of the Antichrist system in Revelation 18:23, where it says, by thy sorceries all nations have been deceived. Pharmakia in the Greek, which apparently involves the use of drugs, incantations, spells, the occult, all under the guise, of course, of religion. So by your, the mistress of witchcraft that sells nations through her whoredoms, and they did literally even sell captives into slavery after they subjugated nations. That's what the devil does. He enslaves people. Know ye not that to whom ye yield yourselves servants to obey, his servants you are, whether sin unto death or righteousness unto life. Verse 5, behold, I am against thee, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will discover thy skirts upon thy face, and I will show the nations thy nakedness and the kingdoms thy shame. Now, he's continuing this analogy of a harlot. And in ancient times, apparently, there was a custom of when a harlot was caught in the act, that she would be brought to a public place where she would be literally stripped naked so that they could see her, the means of her sin, so to speak, and she would be made a gazing stock, and they would throw dirt on her and stones and so forth. And of course, stoning was to be the penalty under the Mosaic law, at least, for adultery. So he's saying, I'm going to discover your nakedness by lifting your skirts up over your face. And so we see in the antitype, God will strip the harlot and make her naked, Revelation 17:16. In other words, she will be seen to be just a tool of the devil instead of being, you know, a representative of God. Now, we're going to have a pre-revealing of that in the sense that 2 Thessalonians 2 lets us know that before the day of the Lord, before the rapture, the man of lawlessness will be revealed. So there'll be a revealing to the saints of God, at least, prior to that time. Verse 6, and I will cast abominable filth upon thee, and make thee vile, and will set thee as a gazing stock. And again, also part of the ancient custom. With gazing stock, you can put Isaiah 14:16. Verse 7, and it shall come to pass that all they that look upon thee shall flee from thee, and say, Nineveh is laid waste. Who will bemoan her? Whence shall I seek comforters for thee? They'll look upon thee, like we read in Isaiah 66:24, they shall look at the carcasses of the sinners. And again, remember the merchant standing afar off and looking at her and mourning for her in Revelation 18, verse 10. Verse 7, it shall come to pass... Well, let's see. I just want to say one more thing in verse 7. He says, whence shall I seek comforters for thee? Remember Nahum? Comfort. Well, there is no comfort. There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. But there is comfort for the people of God. He will be their stronghold in the day of trouble. No comfort for them because they rejected the comforter. The comforter came into the world, but the world knew him not. The world would not receive him. Is that the first bell or is that the last? Last? Okay. Well, we'll undoubtedly be completing the book of Nahum when we come back Wednesday. And then we'll be getting into Zephaniah.